John Muir and Robert Underwood Johnson were opposites in many ways, but even before they met, they had a lot in common. Most notably, a wish to preserve the place that would become Yosemite National Park. My guest can tell us how that partnership came about and what its impact was. He's Dean King, author of Guardians of the Valley, John Muir and the Friendship That Saved Yosemite, published in 2023 by Scribner. And welcome to University of the Air.
Hi, Norman. Great to be here.
I first have to marvel at how quickly the wilderness in this country became settled in the course of, 40 or 50 years after the Lewis and Clark expedition and the early forays of wagon trains and other pioneers into the West. It was already starting to close down in some ways, with Abraham Lincoln declaring the first kind of national park, proto-park, I guess, in terms of Yosemite in the 1860s.
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln gave Yosemite Valley to the state of California to preserve and protect for all the people of the nation, because it was such a beautiful and unique place. And yes, we'd gone coast to coast and we're gobbling up the nation pretty fast at that point. And then, of course, after the war, in rebuilding the nation, the forests would really be under stress, and more loggers would be eating up California.
In those years, while Muir was still out and about pretty much on his own, what was the impetus for Lincoln to sign away Yosemite to the state of California, the valley?
Well, Muir didn't get there until after that. He got there a few years after the Civil War. But the impetus, I think, was, the gold rush had put a lot of stress on Central California and on the Sierra Nevada. There'd been a lot of damage done, and this was a really unique space. I think it was also something positive that the nation could unite around and look forward to and sort of take pride in.
And so we follow Muir and his track in those years leading up to the 1860s, where he first becomes a player on this stage of conservation and maybe even restoration. What led him to become one of the great naturalists?
Well, he was born in Scotland, and early on, his grandfather would take him on walks out in the countryside and along the on the coastline. They would gather birds' nests and things they found, and Muir took a fascination with nature. His father was a strict Christian evangelist and really whipped Bible verses into him. So it was an escape and something Muir cherished. He migrated to the United States with his father and family and ended up in Wisconsin in 1849, the year of the gold rush. And they farmed in Wisconsin. Muir worked basically from dawn to dusk. So he was outside all the time. And I think relief from all that, the farm work that he did, was his fascination with nature and his enjoyment of, watching animals and plant life. And Muir was a very ingenious guy. His father wouldn't let any book but the Bible in the house. But neighbors realized how brilliant Muir was, and they smuggled him in novels and other books. And finally, his father figured it out and said, "Look, well, you can do that, but you can't do that. You got to work. You got to do your Bible work, all that." So Muir built a machine based on a clock that would pull the front legs out from under his bed at 1 a.m. and dump him in a pan of cold water so that he could get up and read. So that was leading. Muir knew he wanted to do something good for mankind. He had a very expansive mind, and he could have been an inventor, and he did go on to invent some things and create some machinery. He went on to work in factories and thought, well, maybe I'll do good for mankind by Making shovel handles and broom handles, very practical. It makes life easier for workers. He also considered being a medical doctor. He really had a love for botany and geology as well. And a factory accident in Indianapolis, where he was working in a wagon wheel factory, temporarily blinded him. And he had a little time to think and realized that nature was the calling that he most wanted to pursue. At that point, he then did his famous walk to the Gulf across the South. That was 1867. And he got malaria. He was chased by alligators. He had all kinds of misadventures on that journey. But by the end of it, he had heard of Yosemite Valley in California and decided to take passage to California and go investigate Yosemite Valley. When he got there, he fell in love with it, and he realized the Sierra Nevada, were his calling. He was a very spiritual young man at that point, and for him, the beauty from, say, Inspiration Point, the waterfalls, it was all to him. It was a God's temple. It was the greatest manifestation of God that he could find, and he wanted to dwell there. He wanted to study it. He figured out that it was glaciers that had created it, which contrary to popular scientific belief at the time. So that's what brought him to Yosemite and kept him there.
Well, it's all well and good to love nature, but how did he support himself?
He wrote about the valley and for magazines and earned some money that way. He also worked in a mill in the valley, and which became a bit of a point later on, but they harvested fallen trees. He was already very sensitive to damage that mankind could do to nature because the gold rush had put so much stress on that area. Gold miners were still stripping the mountainsides. You had, sheep that were eating up the greenery around. And Muir worked as a shepherd actually for a couple of summers, and realized that the damage that they did. He really had an ability to observe and analyze, and to understand that the smallest blade of grass was as important to the environment as the bear or a mountain. It was all, as he would say famously, it was all connected. And so, that's what he saw and what he knew needed to be preserved and protected to maintain the viability of this beautiful valley.
By the time we get into the 1860s, 70s, is he farming in California?
He's not farming. He's living in the valley for a couple years, roaming and examining. Eventually, he does marry the daughter of a fruit farmer, and ends up running a fruit ranch near San Francisco, outside of San Francisco. And so he'll spend a decade doing that. He's already written beautifully about Yosemite Valley and the Sierra Nevada, and there's demand. Robert Underwood Johnson was his editor at Century Magazine, and Johnson's like, "We need you back. We need you to write about it." And even his wife, Louisa Strensel, said, "John, your calling is really writing. The fruit ranch was taking a lot out of him. It was very demanding, and he was a meticulous, brilliant guy and doing very well at it. But they could see that it was, sort of draining his energy and his health." And his wife said, "The ranch is not the most important thing. Your family is, and Muir was a great family man. They had two daughters that he dearly loved, and your writing and what you can do best for humanity is get back to your writing." And so he did.
Writing about nature in Muir's time, I would think in particular, would be kind of a two-edged sword, wouldn't it? Because on the one hand, if your readers are in the big cities of the East for example, and they're reading about how wonderful a place like the Yosemite Valley is, then they all want to rush and see it, and then it becomes developed for tourism. Doesn't that work against what John Muir is trying to do?
Yes and no. I think, you know, contrary to popular belief, Muir wasn't some purist who didn't want, who wanted to just preserve nature as it was and to keep people out. He really wanted to bring people to nature. You know, that was really his ethos. And if you sort of take anything away from his life, it is that, you know, he believed that our people were purified by nature, and that they that it was the manifestation of God, and that they could come there for sort of spiritual salvation. So, and it was a two-edged sword, because if you brought too many people in, then you started to destroy the very nature that was going to sustain you.
Still a problem today.
It is indeed. You know, the overcrowding and the, I mean, he couldn't have imagined that kind of overcrowding. He was even, you know, when there are a few thousand people coming to Yosemite, which is pretty remote in the day, he was worried about it and wanted to make sure that the national park, which he and Johnson had created around the state park that Lincoln had preserved, you know, stayed open and that there was open space for people to come experience it.
But you have to build roads to get them there.
He, you know, he was supportive of you know, bringing the train up to the border of the park, of getting roads to get people there, but also wanted to make sure that you know, there was open grazing still going on in the park. There was grazing going on. The valley had been preserved, but the hills around it had not been preserved, and so you know, he and Johnson came up with the idea of you know, creating the national park. And Johnson said, look, you write me two articles, I will publish them in Century Magazine, and then I'm going to take the magazine down to Washington, put the magazine on the desktops of the congressmen, and we're going to get a bill passed. And that's how Yosemite National Park was created. So yes, I think he wanted to bring people to the park, but he also was very aware, keenly aware, that we needed to protect it. He also knew that he needed to get people there to love nature, to then have the political power to keep these places protected. And really, that's going to lead to the beginning of the modern environmental movement, a sort of grassroots movement where he created the Sierra Club in 1892 with some other professors in the San Francisco area. And their goal was to help recreation in the mountains. Again, they wanted to bring people to the mountains. They wanted to engender that love of the mountains, which they knew, you know, would help us protect them.
Has he at this point then done anything to actually reverse some of the damage to the Yosemite Valley?
Well, I think he understood the restorative qualities of nature, that if we just stop messing it up, you know, it would take care of itself. So, you know, he was fighting to keep the sheep herding out of the valley. He was exploring the Sierra Nevada and talking about the forests and the sequoias and trying to create awareness for all that, because the logging industry really was just clear cutting anything. There were no restrictions on it. And so they were logging right up to the borders of Yosemite, and they even had property within Yosemite. And Muir helped create some land swaps to save parts of Yosemite that were still in private hands.
And he was also involved, he and Robert Underwood Johnson, involved in some kind of, what do we call them, jurisdictional arrangements for the park that would make it more secure. It's been moved over to California at one point. Does it stay in California jurisdiction, or at what point does it become a national thing?
Yeah. Well, the minute they created that national park, it was getting attacked by these these business interests who wanted to continue to mine, to cut trees, to you know, have their herds graze. So there was a constant sort of battle with the state politicians and the federal politicians, and eventually Muir and Johnson, what they really wanted to do and what they needed to do was have the valley, which was in state hands, recessed back to the federal government to create one big national park and have that the governance of it all coordinated. And so that was a longer struggle. That would take them about 15 years to get that to happen. And, you know, in the meantime, Muir and Johnson helped bring about a National Forestry Commission that would create our national forests. Johnson would continue to work with politicians, and even getting President Theodore Roosevelt, when he went on his Western tour, to go camping with Muir in Yosemite Valley, which Roosevelt was quite happy to do. He'd heard of Muir and knew of his writing and was eager to get away from the throngs of well-wishers and, you know, the political world and get out to the countryside.
He was, of course, Roosevelt was, Theodore Roosevelt, a well-known outdoorsman internationally.
Yeah, and a lover of hunting and preserving nature, largely four hunters. And he and Muir would have an interesting back and forth on that, but they really, had a meeting of the minds in 1903 when Roosevelt was out there. And even after Roosevelt leaves Muir, you can hear some of Muir's elocution in Roosevelt's speeches. And, you know, of course, Roosevelt went on to name national parks and national monuments and wildlife refuges many, and was our greatest conservation president. So, but Muir certainly had an influence on that. And then President Taft came out and same again. Muir was very persuasive and showing, you know, he had the Yosemite Valley to show off, and it was very powerful combination.
What do we have of the correspondence or dialogue between Muir and Theodore Roosevelt?
There's a good bit of a back and forth, and praiseworthy. Very, they definitely were simpatico. Roosevelt helped Muir whenever he could, but on occasion, politics came to bear. Gifford Pinchot, our first forester, was really Theodore Roosevelt's right hand man when it came to nature, and into governing nature in using our natural resources. And Pinchot was more practical in his desire to use our natural resources and to basically in some ways farm our forests. Not that Muir was completely impractical. He understood that we needed to use these resources to build the nation and for many uses. But there would be some clashing between Pinchot and Muir, and Roosevelt sort of stood above it, and he tried to smooth things over. And you know, really, Muir wouldn't have had so much a say as if he hadn't met with Roosevelt and gotten that influence.
We're going to look at the relationship between John Muir and the aforementioned Robert Underwood Johnson when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Dean King, the author of Guardians of the Valley, John Muir and the Friendship That Saved Yosemite, published in 2023 by Scribner. And we're looking at this partnership, or we're going to get more into the partnership between John Muir, outdoorsman and naturalist, and this East Coast publisher, Robert Underwood Johnson, who was very crucial in the whole conservation and restoration movement that John Muir was so instrumental in making effective in this country. Johnson had what experience with nature, Dean?
Well, Johnson's a fascinating character. He was 15 years younger than Muir, raised in Indiana, and really, Muir would be the great natural influence in his life. But he was a nature lover. His father took him out on walks, and they, enjoyed nature early on. Johnson was a precocious young man. He worked in a train depot at the age of 11 during the Civil War, and was very good with the telegraph, and even exchanging telegraphs with Thomas Edison. During the war, sometimes he would get the war news and have to go out and tell a family that they lost a son. When Lincoln was assassinated, it was this young Johnson who took the telegraph and had to go out on the depot and tell everybody. He had an amazing way of being, at important places at important times. He was later in Chicago during the Great Fire there, and describes that incredibly. And then when he was working for Scribner there and selling books. And then he got sort of a promotion to go to New York City and get into editorial. And as he was going there, he had the he took an overnight train and had the conductor wake him up when they went by Niagara Falls, and saw the wonder of that. So he was always taken with nature, but he then lived in New York City and was at the center of the nation's conversation, really. Century Magazine was a place where we discussed our issues, and it was very literary, in a way that magazines were, very much a powerful force in that day. He helped put together a series about the Civil War that took place over 3 years, where they interviewed the leaders on both sides of certain battles, and really created a marvelous history of the Civil War that's still very important today. It doubled the circulation of the magazine from 125,000 to 250,000 subscribers, and he became influential. He would go on to spearhead a movement to create international copyright, and that got him involved in politics. The magazine basically loaned him out to that movement, and he'd go down to Washington and lobby the Congress people. So he learned the ways of legislation, all of which, were setting him up to be a force in the environmental movement.
And at what point does he start expressing this interest in environmentalism in print?
So he was Muir's editor early on. They didn't meet, during the 70s, and they didn't meet because they were writing to each other from across the country. But after Johnson did the Civil War series, then they were looking for another series, and they did it on the Gold Rush. So Johnson eventually went out to San Francisco to finish off that series, and that's when he and Muir met in the palace, as you read at the beginning, that wonderful meeting. And Muir convinced Johnson to, take a break and go out to Yosemite with him and see it. Two things happened. They got out there, and Johnson did look and see for with his own eyes how, beautiful it was and how magnificent the place was. But he also saw, as Muir was telling him, that it wasn't taken care of well enough, and that it was at risk and needed greater protection. And that's when, Johnson was a real man of action, as was Muir, but Muir in a different realm. Johnson said, "Look, you write me two articles, and I'm going to publish them in Century, and I'll go down to Washington with that, and we'll get something done here." And so it was the beginning of a brilliant relationship in that regard. They would work together for about 4 decades, and there's volumes of correspondence between the two. A letter took about 6 days to go across the nation at that time. So.
Well, things haven't changed much these days. But yeah, 6 days, a lot could happen if people are cutting down trees or somehow affecting the wilderness there.
Really fun to delve into and go through. The University of the Pacific has gathered all this correspondence, and really there's a history of the sort of nascent environmental movement in their correspondence.
Are there points where they have to kind of come to terms with each other?
Sure. Johnson could be considered pushy. He'd say, Muir, you need to start an association out there. I could do it out here in New York, but you don't want that. You don't want New Yorkers telling Californians what to do with the mountains. And Muir would tell him, look, I love the outdoors. I want to write about it, but I'm not the guy to start any kind of a group like that. And Johnson was, would insist that he do it, and they'd go back and forth. And Johnson finally found some professors that wanted to do it, and he got Muir pulled in. And of course, they elected Muir president of it. And that was the Sierra Club
Sure.
in 1892. And Muir would stay president for the rest of his life. And I think it was something that he came to really cherish. At one point, as they're trying to create legislation, Muir tells Johnson, "You've turned me into a lobbyist." But I think he's proud of it. He's secretly proud of it.
How does the Sierra Club, as founded in the 1890s, do you think compare with the goals of the Sierra Club today?
Well, I of course they've evolved a lot, but I think the basic tenets are the same. It's to preserve and protect nature, and also to bring people to nature. I think the great lesson from all that is that the way we will take care of our planet is by creating understanding among as many people as we can and love for nature. That's how we get skin in the game, and people really care, and we'll put resources into it and bring political influence to bear, much better than sort of arguing and fighting over what we do. And so I think the Sierra Club understands that. It wants to bring people to nature, which is what Muir always did, always talked about. And Muir, he also had this deep faith from his childhood. He never lost that. It just sort of morphed into him finding it. His church was in nature, and he always had this wonderful faith to the very end that the people would do what is right, and that we would take care of the planet in the long run.
Do you have a sense that Muir read other, let's say, natural loving, if not naturalist writers from before his time?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he was a fan of Thoreau and Emerson. Emerson even came out and visited him, and Emerson got Muir quickly. Even though Muir was self-educated largely, he went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison for a couple of years, but was always struggling financially. Emerson wanted Muir to come out to Boston and teach at Harvard. But Muir resisted and realized that, well, the reason why you want me to come out there is because I'm doing what I do, which is living in nature. And you could do that, or
It's a
but
paradox.
yeah. So if I go to Boston, I won't be doing that. And Muir really he sort of clung to nature. He would travel around the world several times. He'd go to Alaska, he would come to the East Coast, but it was always, he really wanted to get out to see the planet, to find trees, to go see glaciers, to explore nature. That's what he really loved to do.
How broad was his reach, or what sort of other partnerships might he have had with conservationists, naturalists in other parts of the country?
Well, John Burroughs was a good friend of his. He went to John Burroughs's cabin in upstate New York, and they admired each other much. Emerson came out to visit with him, but Muir didn't get east until after Emerson had died. But he went to pay tribute to him at the cemetery, and so there were others from Harvard that had come out earlier. Muir had a mentor named Jean Carr, who was the wife of a professor at Wisconsin. She was a botanist, and they really they were soulmates in a lot of way. And she, her husband came out and taught at Berkeley, and she would tell all the visiting professors, "Look, there's this guy out in Yosemite. You need to go see Yosemite, and you need to look up John Muir. He needs to be your guide." So there was a steady procession of naturalists that came out to see him, to hear what he had to say, and Muir learned from them, and he was connected to the chain of thought through that, and he was also a voracious reader as well.
When he and Robert Underwood Johnson did their, I'll call it politicking, lobbying, mostly, of course, done upfront and personal by Johnson, what sort of opposition did they have to overcome?
Well, there was a lot of vitriol from industry, which then, you know, of course, they went to their political representatives and brought that kind of force to bear in the state of California and then in Congress. Eventually, so they created the national park. They fought for recession. They created the forestry, or helped create the Forestry Service. They did a lot of good there. Eventually, they would San Francisco, which was looking for a water source, would come calling on the national park. And really, that would be the last 15 years of Muir's life would be spent fighting to keep San Francisco from damming up Hetch Hetchy in the northwest of Yosemite National Park and creating a reservoir there, which Muir feared take about half of the park out of play, and so that was a very heated political battle.
How did he feel about damming in general?
Well, there's again, he was a practical man who knew that we needed to use our resources, but and he was okay if they wanted to dam up the river lower down. He understood that it was important for the city to have clean drinking water, but there were a lot of rivers they could have tapped in Northern California. They also could have dammed the river lower down outside of the Tuolumne River, outside of the park. But of course, it was much easier for the city to come to the federal government and say, "We want to, dam it up there and take that space," because if the federal government gave it to them, they wouldn't have to. They wouldn't have to buy property from private hands. They wouldn't have to condemn things and go through the court system, and they wouldn't make constituents angry because the federal government already controlled that property. Muir realized that, look, if you come take this piece of the park, what are you going to do? There was Yellowstone Park. There are other parks. How are we ever going to protect anything if any city that needs some resources could come calling and just take it?
Setting a precedent.
Yeah, it was a real matter of principle for Muir.
So he won the Hetch Hetchy debate. It did not get dammed.
It did get dammed, unfortunately. Yes. So that debate, he almost won, and then there was the earthquake of 1906 and the Great Fire in San Francisco, which was so destructive, and it really. Shifted the mentality. I think the federal government felt like we need to do something for San Francisco, and San Francisco still wanted to dam up Hetch Hetchy, which is, again, it's in the northwest part of Yosemite National Park, and that would give them the persuasiveness to win this battle, which would be decided in 1914 by Congress.
In the very last year of Muir's life.
It was. And, some people say, well, Muir died on Christmas Eve of that year, 1914. And some people say he died of a broken heart, having lost this battle. One wonderful thing that I discovered in my research of this book was that Muir, that's part of the Muir legend, but it certainly wasn't true, because he didn't have a broken heart. You couldn't break Muir's heart. His faith was so deep that He to the very end, he was telling Johnson, even though they went through this long battle, and used the Sierra Club and generated thousands and thousands of letters, really creating the modern environmental movement through this battle, Muir realized that all the fighting they had done was gonna pay off, and eventually, and he knew he maintained that faith that people would eventually get it and do the right thing, and that good would prevail. And so, Johnson was going through some hard times. He lost his job at the Century and was
Why?
struggling. Well, the magazine world was changing at the time. There were the politics, but also there were other cheaper magazines that were printing for that were coming out that were cheaper. The production values weren't as good, and Johnson, his board wanted to do something with less integrity, and Johnson resisted that. He was kind of old school on that matter.
Did his enthusiasm, Johnson's enthusiasm for the, I'll call it, environmental movement, cost him points at Century?
It may have had something to do with it. He put an awful lot of time into it and a lot of energy. And he would be up, until 1 in the morning writing senators about things and always getting, Muir's pieces into the press and other places as well. So it was a very socially conscious magazine, and they valued that kind of community service. But at a certain point, you've got to think that it was draining, resources in Johnson's time quite a bit. Their battle, Muir realized up to the end was going to benefit mankind. And in his letters to Johnson, he was constantly saying, "Johnson, you've done great work. You're a great man." And we're always giving Johnson credit for creating Yosemite National Park, which Johnson did for Muir as well. He said, No, you did it. And it's a wonderful part of their relationship. They were very accomplished, but very humble, authentically so. And so they lost the battle for Hetch Hetchy, but really they won the war. They created this grassroots environmental movement, which would set the stage for 20th century of environmentalism, and they also set the stage for the National Park Service, which was created 2 years after they lost the Hetch Hetchy battle, because basically the nation realized that they were right. You do need, if you're going to preserve these places, you need to set some rules. You can't just let anybody come in. Not that San Francisco is just anybody, but you can't let, entities come in
One after the other.
So they created the Park Service, which would eventually standardize care for the parks, create a professional service that could really provide for the needs, and also get funding from the federal government in a normal way, instead of they were constantly vying against each other in their early years and not really getting appropriations much at all, and having to come up with new policy. Do we let cars come in the early years? And all kinds of issues were coming up. So that was a sort of a watershed moment in 1916 when the Park Service was created.
We're going to look further at John Muir and Robert Underwood Johnson and the Yosemite National Park when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Dean King. He's the author of Guardians of the Valley, John Muir and the Friendship That Saved Yosemite, published in 2023 by Scribner. It is the story of John Muir and the publisher, Robert Underwood Johnson, and the relationship between them that was so powerful in the creation of what would become Yosemite National Park. In this strongly spiritual aspect of John Muir, Dean, all of his love for and experience with the outdoors, do we have any sense of his relationship with Native Americans?
We do. Muir early on, even when he was in Wisconsin, saw Native Americans moving through the landscape, and it expressed a real empathy for them at the time, and sort of shame that they'd been treated the way they were, that by basically an invasive species that had come in and were driving them off their land. I think, later on, he's so eloquent on nature. I think there is a bit of a void in him, because he lived through an era when we continued to drive them off their land and continued to break treaties and do them wrong. And he didn't talk about that much. He was so focused on nature and the natural world, that we probably wish that he had talked about that more. There's a sort of a passage also that I think is really misinterpreted, where he comes upon a group of Native Americans in Yosemite or just outside of the valley. They the degradation was, I think, because the white people had driven them off their land, had changed the way they live, had brought in alcohol and tobacco and things that were destroying their way of life. And one reason we know this is because that Muir continually, through his writing, admired the way they moved through the land, the way they could live off the land. So I do think that's a bit misunderstood, his feelings there. But I also do wish that he had maybe been a little more explicit in his concerns about the way the nation was treating them.
How did Muir feel about forest fires, that they have kind of a different reputation today than they would have even 50 or 60 years ago?
Yeah. Well, remarkably, Muir did realize that they sculpted the woods and used fire to help with their hunting, to create better hunting grounds. Muir was fascinated by fire. I mean, he well understood sort of the cycle of life and the importance of fire. And there's a remarkable moment where he goes and lives in a fire. He's going through the Sierra Nevada, comes upon a fire, and he goes in there. He finds a secure place by a fallen sequoia and ties his mule up there. And he goes and observes and watches the way the fire is spreading and observes the way it hits the trees and what it does there. And it's a really beautiful description of fire. And I think he understood that it was a part of that cycle of life. I think I'm not sure that he could have predicted, the way drought is now in the level of forest fires we're having. But even, back in the day when they set up this forestry commission to create that would create our national forests, Gifford Pinchot went out to do his sort of due diligence looking at the forest. And the thing that really amazed him the most was how much fire damage there was in these remote forests. It's something that's not new. It always existed. And we maybe tend to think of, it with a romanticized lens that forests were, just pristine and gorgeous, but they always had,
These
they're
cycles.
living things. Yeah.
Were there mysteries that John Muir never solved during his lifetime that we feel we have solved today?
About the forests, I'm not really sure if there, are. I mean, he was so farsighted that he would go and explain that the grass is important above the valley, and the shrubs and the trees, because they hold the snowpack. The snowpack is then slowly absorbed into the ground, and then it's released over the course of the spring and summer. Because he was a farmer in the East, a fruit rancher, he understood, even that kind of far-reaching thinking that maybe we think is a little more modern. But how important that shrub and that grass was in the mountains to, the water that we could use on the coast.
Did his two daughters, either of them, become naturalists in any kind of networking way?
I think they became nature lovers. One of the things that the Sierra Club did was create the high trips that took people out into the Sierra Nevada, largely, and now of course the Sierra Club does it all over the nation and the world. But and so they did become lovers of nature. They enjoyed the high trips, and they became great supporters of his legacy.
Now, being out in the outdoors, of course, Kaz does have a wonderful spiritual component to it for a lot of people. But at the same time, if you get a little bit off the path or the weather changes on you quickly, which I'm sure it can do in Yosemite, suddenly it's not that much fun. Were there instances in which John Muir recorded having not all that much fun getting caught out there?
Well, it's really remarkable. He was caught in some pretty sticky situations, and somehow, seems to thrive even more. There'll be cases where he'll be caught in a snowstorm. He'll build a little shelter, and the next thing you know, a bird will fly into his shelter to take refuge, and he'll be trying to feed the bird crumbs and take care of the bird, and it's just kind of mind-blowing that you're worried about, his survival, and he's taking care of a little bird, and then observing the snow and the wildlife that comes out in the morning, and he doesn't know when he's going to get out of there. It's still snowing. It might snow for days. He's caught on top of Mount Shasta at one point in his shirt sleeves during a blizzard, and lives on a fumarole that's, it's volcanic, and so there's steam coming up out of these vents. And he's alternately getting roasted and frozen by the blizzard. It's just unbelievable.
How to have a great time in nature.
Yeah. He was also well known for going out with very few provisions. And just, anybody who traveled with him, most of the time they marveled at the way he moved through the wilderness and his knowledge, but they also suffered because he ate very little. He didn't really care for high cuisine. So what they did eat wasn't good, but he would take bread and coffee or tea and sometimes meat extract, meat juice, they called it back then, was kind of a health potion that he would take. But he was a rugged, guy, lean, mean, sort of fighting machine who could move through nature almost like a wild animal.
Now, I'm sure that in your researches for Guardians of the Valley, you have done considerable tramping in the footsteps of John Muir. But dare I say, in relative comfort compared to what would have been available to John Muir 150 years ago, do you feel that there's still a little bit of gap between you and him in terms of the amount of suffering you've done for nature?
Yeah. Well, I whine a lot more about the suffering I do in nature. I was a Boy Scout early on in life, and I can remember not being very well prepared on some of my overnight hikes. And one night I woke up in the freezing cold, and a banana I had taken in my dinner and lost was frozen to my leg.
Muir never had that problem, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't think he did. I went out there and tried to retrace his first route into Yosemite National, well, it was into the state park. And I went through Coulterville, and I was in a four-wheel drive vehicle, but I got lost up on the fire pass and thought I was going to have to spend the night up there, and I was scared just having to spend the night in my four-wheel drive vehicle. So I did get out. It took several hours to get out of the maze of unmarked roads. But
did Muir ever get lost? Did he record? Just saying, I really have very little idea where I am.
I don't think I ever heard him say he was lost, because when he was out there, even when he was wandering through the South, sometimes he didn't really know where he was. He'd be in a swamp at one point. He was looking for a place in the middle of a swamp to spend the night. He was scared of alligators.
A good idea.
But but he didn't have a panic gene and he didn't have a fear gene. And one of my favorite moments in the book is when he's looking over Yosemite Falls for the first time down into the valley, and he's crept out to the very edge, and he's looking out and studying the beads of water as the water cascades over the edge of the bluff. It's both dying, the stream is dying, and it's being reborn into a new life that it's going to have in the valley. And the way he describes that, and the way, he sees God in the refraction of the light through the water, and yet he's hanging on to the edge of the cliff. It is just nerve-wracking, and truly amazing.
Possible to compare Yosemite National Park with today, with the way it would have been the last time John Muir saw it in 1914?
Well, I mean, the features are still the same. I mean, there are a lot more people there. I was out in October though, and I'm always amazed that you can find your space. You can still, despite, the throngs of people that go to see this glory. There's the tunnel view, which has that beautiful long view of Half Dome and Bridal Veil Falls, and there are a lot of cars there, but you can hike up the path and go to the old Inspiration Point about a mile up. And I did that and saw maybe five people there. In Sequoia National Forest, I drove several miles down dirt roads in a four-wheel drive vehicle, then hiked in a mile and a half and had lunch with the bull tree, which is perhaps it's one of the largest trees in the world. And for 2 hours, never saw another soul. So, to be able to sit with that beautiful tree that Muir talked about back in the day, and sort of commune with it, you can still do that. And I think it's really remarkable.
What would you most like to know about Muir that you don't know?
Wow. I feel like I got to know him really well. I guess the thing that history will never be able to answer is what would have happened if Muir had actually gotten out to Washington, D.C. and testified when they were having the Hetch Hetchy battle. And for various reasons, health and because he just really didn't want to go east, he didn't do it. But he was so persuasive when he spoke, and I just think his presence there might have made a difference. We're not going to know that. I'd love to, have that conversation with him. And I know Johnson tried to get him to come, and other representatives of the Sierra Club were there, and his word was read into the record. But boy, if Muir had been able to, walk those halls and be present, I would have liked to have been there.
Well, thank you for getting us pretty close to John Muir, Dean King.
Thank you, Norman, and pleasure to be here.
He's the author of Guardians of the Valley, John Muir, and The Friendship That Saved Yosemite, published in 2023 by Scribner. Pleasure having you on the show. And I hope you can join us the next time around for University of the Air.